meeting of the Washington County Planning Commission for Wednesday, January 15th, 2020. We'll recognize all members of the Planning Commission present this evening with the exception of Tegan Inlow, who is ill and excused. We have a relatively brief docket this evening, but we will take a director's report to start with, please.
Thank you. First off, we hopefully have in front of you, per your request from a couple meetings ago, a summary of actions on last year's ordinances that kind of shows the progression from staff recommendation to your recommendation to what the board did. So feel free to go through that at your leisure. We have two things today, kind of applying FD20 to urban growth boundary expansion areas. Going to give you a little overview of that and talk about the short-term rentals issue paper that will be coming out soon. I want to talk a little bit about the commission itself and vacancies. The board is having a work session on the 28th to discuss their next steps. We have, I believe, 7 active applicants. We're hoping that prior to your meeting, they will make a decision, but that's theirs to make, and we can't guarantee that.
Can I ask a question, a technical question about that? So does that, they don't make their decision at the work session, they discuss it, then they make the decision at a regular meeting?
Correct, and I believe the Tuesday before the meeting, is that when we're scheduled to go back?
Okay, so that they would have
They do have an time opportunity. To make it
okay,
before.
Thank you.
So in terms of the 19th, one of the things we're going to focus on is the draft long-range planning work program, and just give you an update on where that is at. Another thing that we may talk about is what we've kind of go over the 2019 legislation relative to planning issues. I do want to note that you'll have to elect a new chair and vice chair at that meeting in February. So that will be one thing on the agenda. I think that's about it for me.
All right. Does anyone have any questions of Mr. Back? Thank you. I'd like to welcome those members of the public that are here with us this evening. We're grateful for your attendance. This time, we would provide the opportunity for anyone who is here, not on a matter that is part of our regular agenda, to address us for up to 3 minutes. Does anyone wish to do that? All right. We'll then go to our work session, and we've got the FD20 and UGB report. You gonna run that, Todd, or how is Teresa gonna let you do that, or how's that working there? Okay.
Is this on? No, okay. Good evening, Chair Vile, Vice Chair Petrillo, and other commissioners. I'm Todd Borkowitz, Associated Planner with Community Planning. I'm here tonight to brief you on the status of the UGB expansions in Washington County. So Metro Council recently approved four UGB expansions, including 3 of them in Washington County. In this presentation, I'll briefly explain the UGB expansion process, highlight 3 UGB expansion areas in Washington County, and describe the county's process for accepting these areas into the UGB and the urban area. The Urban Growth Boundary, or UGB, supports Oregon's planning goals through protection of farms and forests from urban sprawl and promoting the efficient use of land, public facilities, and services inside the UGB. The UGB is administered by Metro, who must approve expansions prior to acknowledgement by the state of Oregon. In 2011, urban and rural reserve designations were established to guide long-term land use outside of the UGB. New UGB expansions are generally expected to occur in areas designated as urban reserve areas, or URAs. In 2018, Beaverton, Hillsborough, and King City each submitted a proposal for UGB expansion into an adjacent URA. Each city, as required by Metro, developed a concept plan for the proposed expansion areas. These plans were developed to achieve Metro 6 desired outcomes for UGB expansion and focused on allowing and encouraging different housing types. Metro approved the three proposals in December of 2018. After Metro approval, UGB expansions were subject to acknowledgement by the state of Oregon. This past July, the Division of Land Conservation and Development, or DLCD, referred approval of the proposed expansions to the Land Conservation and Development Commission, or LCDC, and then who then approved them. The final order is now being drafted by DLCD, and once issued on or before January 22nd, a week from today, a 21-day appeal period will begin prior to acknowledgement.
Have you got a map in your slide deck?
I do, yes. Okay. The comprehensive plan refers to requires that future development 20-acre designation, or FD20, be applied to land added to the UGB through legislative amendment, allowing these areas to be protected and retained for future urban development until annexation occurs. FD20 aims to encourage and retain limited interim uses unless otherwise specified by an applicable community plan until comprehensive planning for future urban development of these areas is complete. Minimum lot area for new development is 20 acres in most instances. New development must be constructed in a manner that does not interfere with future conversion of the land to planned urban densities and or uses. Application of FD20 was identified as a Tier 1 task in the 2019-2020 long-range planning work program, but was postponed to the upcoming ordinance season due to delays by the state's acknowledgement. And this begins the maps. Here are the three proposed UGB expansion areas. Hillsborough is in the north, followed by Beaverton in the middle, and King City to the south.
Back up one map there.
All right.
If you would, please. So the reason I asked about the map is I thought for some reason the Tigard had an expansion as part of this last set of approvals, but it doesn't look like that.
There is a fourth expansion, but in this we're only talking about the three expansions.
So Wilsonville was the fourth expansion, and that was in the Clackamas County portion of Wilsonville. But Tigard is starting a concept plan for the little area. If you can see here
north
where it says King
Road
City. Yeah. So it's that little area that's an urban reserve now, and they're just starting concept planning for that area. And I think their intent is in the next kind of mid-cycle that they would make a request for that to come into the UGB.
That was my confusion. I, for some reason, thought that had come in with this round, but it did not.
No, King City had talked with Tigard and had hoped that they would do it at the same time, but that didn't happen, and so they're just starting that now.
We do have a map that's part of the. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, has Tigard showed any interest in doing anything south of Shoals Ferry Road in their urban reserve?
Not that I've heard. I don't know if anyone else.
You're talking about west of River Terrace?
Yes.
Yeah.
West of River Terrace.
Kind of south of where the pipe is coming along there right now.
Strobel, whatever the road is, it goes down the Grabhorns. Anyway, between there and Roy Rogers Road.
Yeah.
Or between there and the urban growth boundary.
Is that area actually?
It's Tigard's Urban Reserve.
Oh, it is Urban Reserve. And then there's a part that's undesignated. We haven't heard anything about that area, but I haven't seen a map that shows the extent of the area that they're hoping to concept plan.
So far, the only urbanized portion of that is River Terrace, the little chunk there.
At the end of our slide deck, we have a map of the remaining urban reserve areas that we could show. The Hillsborough UGB expansion, the first area, it's proposed by Hillsborough within with the Witch Hazel Village South URA. It's the smallest of the three areas. It contains 150 gross acres, half of which are buildable and planned to accommodate 850 homes. Non-buildable land includes GO5 resources around Gordon Creek, bisecting the expansion area, and near the Tualatin River to the southwest. The next proposed expansion was by Beaverton and encompasses the entirety of the Cooper Mountain URA. Cooper Mountain contains 1,232 gross acres, half of which are buildable and planned to accommodate 3,760 homes. Non-buildable land includes GO5 resource areas around McKernan Creek and multiple streams that feed it. The proposed expansion area by King City is within the Beef Bend South URA. Beef Bend South?
Yeah, pause on that one for just a minute, if you would. Go ahead and talk, just don't go to the next slide.
Oh, okay. Beef Bend South contains 528 gross acres, 400 of which are buildable and planned to accommodate 3,300 homes. Non-buildable land includes GO5 resources areas around the Tualatin River to the south.
And that boundary follows the river, but then doesn't include the peninsula area there. Do you know why that was?
Are you talking area to the south or to the north of the...
To the south of the included shaded section, there's kind of a river peninsula there that...
I don't believe that's part of the a URA.
So that's the extent of the reserves.
Okay.
And so, yeah, they can only add what's in the urban reserve. Beyond that, it's rural reserve. And I'm not sure, but a lot of that may be river... floodplain.
That is the chunk that Metro bought. Yep. This right here.
It's adjacent to the refuge. Yeah,
I can't remember the name of that farm, but there's a family's farm that Metro bought there.
Okay,
go ahead, sorry.
No worries. So in total, the expansion includes over 1,900 gross acres, more than 1,000 of which are buildable and planned to accommodate over 7,900 homes. Moving the proposed expansion areas into the UGB means removing them from the Rural Natural Resources Plan and adding them to the Comprehensive Framework Plan for the urban area and the respective community plan. Current rural land use designations will be replaced with the FD20 designation. Reserve designations will be removed, and GO5 resources will transfer directly and not be changed. Community plans impacted and needing amendment include the East Hillsborough Community Plan, Aloha, Reedville, Cooper Mountain Community Plan, and the Bull Mountain Community Plan. Each expansion area will be assigned to a sub-area within their respective community plan. The land use and GO5 designations will be applied, and each zone will be assigned the default Zone B maximum parking designation. That concludes my presentation. I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Questions of Mr. Borowitz? All right, thank you very much.
Thanks.
So this may well be one of the first ordinances that you see in the ordinance season, and so that's why we thought it would be good to have a little work session.
You mean on the expansion?
Right, sorry, yes, completing, finishing up on the UGB expansions, the work that we need to do to FD20 and get it in the community plans, that will be one of the first ordinances that we do.
Zan, please.
All right, I'm just waiting for my presentation to queue up. I'm going to be talking about short-term rentals, issues and considerations about them. The 2019 long-range planning work program included writing an issue paper about short-term rentals and issues involving possibly regulating them. And I've been assigned to work on that issue paper, and here's some of the issues that will be looked at. So over the past 5 years, long-range planning and also the board have received comments from residents expressing concerns about four to five currently operating short-term rentals that are in the urban unincorporated area. And the concerns that have been expressed about them were primarily about concerns about noise associated with events, typically events occurring in the evening, on-street parking impacts, litter and traffic. And so this item, short-term rentals, was a Tier 2 work program item for the previous 4 years, and then this past year, creating an issue paper became a Tier 1 work program item. So what are short-term rentals? There's not an official federal or state definition of them, but several local governments in the region define them as either housing units or portions of housing units that are rented or leased for periods of less than 30 days. And so there are many online booking platforms for short-term rentals. Some of the ones that people are most familiar with are Airbnb and Vacasa and HomeAway, but there are actually dozens of online platforms where these are advertised. And so the county does not regulate short-term rentals. Our community development code allows dwellings in all residential districts, but the code does not differentiate among dwellings that are occupied by owners versus dwellings that are occupied by long-term renters versus dwellings operated by short-term renters. It doesn't slice and dice any more finely than just allowing dwellings. So we don't know exactly how many short-term rentals are operating in the unincorporated county. There was a 2017 study that was done. The individual that authored the study was working with Airbnb and was provided with some numbers by Airbnb, and they subtracted out the number of short-term rentals in the part of the metro region that corresponds with the city of Portland. And then what they had left for the metro region urban areas was about 1,000 short-term rentals. And that sort of leftover area includes the county's urban unincorporated area. The number of dwellings in the county is about 200,000. So if that 2017 figure is still accurate, short-term rentals may constitute a relatively small portion of dwellings in the county. So there's some potential reasons why both allowing short-term rentals and providing some regulations for them could be beneficial. Short-term rentals provide owners of property or long-term renters of property with additional income that they can use to help pay their mortgage or help assist them with property maintenance expenses. And short-term rentals can also contribute to the area's economy by promoting tourism and more tourism and provide additional lodging options. Depending on what the regulations might be, it could allow a local government to potentially prevent or reduce negative neighborhood livability impacts like noise and parking. And also, again, depending what on what a local government might do with regulations. It could allow the local government to maximize retention of affordable housing, for example, by perhaps limiting short-term rentals to certain types of dwellings and not allowing them in other types of dwellings. And as an example, the city of Hood River wanted to make sure that their accessory dwelling units would still be used for long-term renters and owners. So they allow short-term rentals, but they don't allow accessory dwelling units to be used as short-term rentals. Regulations could also require short-term rentals to comply with fire and life safety standards to help guests that are staying in houses that they're unfamiliar with. And it could allow the county to have a mechanism to enforce certain requirements or revoke a short-term rental approval if the short-term rental is sort of a bad actor.
I tend to travel a lot, and I can tell you that this phenomenon is not just Oregon or the United States. It's the world now is seeing this. But I've noticed in particularly South America and Europe that the owners of units that I've stayed in are much more sensitive or seem to be much more sensitive about things like parking and noise. It seems that that's how jurisdictions, at least outside of the U.S., are dealing with this, is with beefed up enforcement for the actual impacts on neighbors. Has that been the experience of any of the jurisdictions here in Oregon that you were able to capture in looking at this?
The jurisdictions that I looked at, and I am going to talk about them in a few minutes too, but the ones that have short-term rental-specific regulations in place say that they've found basically just setting forth expectations for what's acceptable, sometimes even if they cannot enforce it, does seem to result in less problems. I'll talk a little bit more about that as we go on, but some impacts are sort of tough to enforce for, and so sometimes there are sort of proxy things that a local government can do to kind of get at limiting a negative impact that are sort of kind of around the way. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. But there's also some potential challenges with developing regulations for short-term rentals. Right now, Clackamas County is working on developing regulations for short-term rentals, and they have a draft regulations on their web page. And they are going to be going to their Board of Commissioners later in January for like a first reading of those. And I think there'll be subsequent board hearings to kind of keep working on those. But they had, Clackamas County had done, had also looked at other nearby jurisdictions and had questioned nearby jurisdictions about how did this work for you, City of Hood River, when you were working on this? And the feedback that they got, that Clackamas County got, was that when these other jurisdictions that do have short-term rental regulations were bringing them through public hearings process, it was a very contentious process because there are multiple stakeholders that have pretty divergent views about the issue, so it wasn't necessarily easy to get to like a consensus. The other potential challenge is if short-term rentals are explicitly allowed, and this is dependent on sort of how a local government would allow them or whether the local government would have any sort of mitigation. If they're explicitly allowed, it has the potential to increase housing costs by encouraging the removal of housing from long-term rental or owner occupancy into the short-term rental market. And then there are enforcement issues that I'll talk about in a few minutes that make it potentially challenging to deal with short-term rentals that are bad actors that aren't being sensitive to their surrounding neighborhood.
So if they're implicitly allowed, as they are now in Washington County, for example, the idea is there's probably people doing it, but there's not as many as if we said it is allowed and regulated it?
I guess so, although I'm not sure if that's really a true statement.
I'm dubious.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that's really a true statement, but it just sort of raises the issue about if you're explicitly saying you're allowed, has the local government looked at, are they aware of what impacts that explicit allowance will have? I looked at about 15 other local counties and cities and how they treat short-term rentals. I found that a slight majority do have short-term rental-specific regulations, and I'll talk about which communities those are and sort of what some of the common elements of their regulations are. I also found several communities that do not have short-term rental-specific regulations, and I'm actually going to talk about those first. So these are the communities that do not have short-term rental-specific regulations. The city of Eugene approaches short-term rentals pretty much the same as Washington County does, where their community development code has an allowance for dwellings in residential areas, but doesn't go any further about saying like anything about the tenancy of those dwellings.
Sam, sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah.
In Washington County, we are collecting lodging tax, though.
We are. Yes,
so that,
we are.
That is a regulated aspect of this, correct?
We are getting transient lodging tax. I think what is a little bit of a black box is that right now it's our finance department that's getting the transient lodging tax from the online booking platforms. And we have, the county has had a voluntary collection agreement with Airbnb since 2016. And then in 2018, there was a House bill, Oregon House bill, that required all online booking platforms to start remitting transient lodging taxes to all Oregon local governments. So when that law became effective, then our finance department said they also started to get transient lodging tax payments from Vacasa and HomeAway and some of the others. The thing about these payments, though, is that they're a lump sum payments per month, and the online booking platforms don't indicate how many short-term rentals those payments represent or where they are. So it's sort of a black box where finance is getting these payments, but that there's not really any way to know whether the county's actually getting the correct amount of transient lodging tax. So it's a little bit mysterious, I guess. So some of these other jurisdictions, Multnomah County, Yamhill, and then Beaverton, Hillsboro, and Tigard, although they don't have short-term rental specific regulations, if they're asked by an applicant, you know, about, I want to get approval of a short-term rental, they are told that in their jurisdictions, short-term rentals are a subset of another type of land use. Like, for example, in Multnomah County considers short-term rentals a subset of a bed and breakfast use. So that's the type of application they would require an applicant to go through. Yamhill County, I can't recall what their category is. It's either bed and breakfast or home occupation or commercial lodging. City of Beaverton, it's commercial lodging. City of Hillsboro, it's bed and breakfast. And City of Tigard, I think it might be, I actually can't recall. But they put them in another category. And what that does is that these other categories are only allowed in high-density residential zones or commercial zones. So somebody that wanted to operate an STR in a lower-density residential zone just doesn't have a legal path in these other jurisdictions to do that. And planning representatives from Multnomah County, Beaverton, Hillsborough, and Tigard have all indicated that at some point in the future, they do want to look at the issue of short-term rentals and figure out if they want to develop short-term rental-specific regulations, but it hasn't gone up to the top priority of their projects at this point in time.
Can I ask a question? So let's say I lived in Beaverton in an area where, because of density, I couldn't have one of these, and I still go online and offer my house up, and people utilize it.
I think their code enforcement is complaint driven, like our code enforcement is. So I'm guessing if a short-term rental operator is careful enough to make sure that that their short-term rental operates in a discreet fashion that doesn't disturb the neighbors, that that would result in nobody complaining, and that would result in the city not knowing. So so I think that's probably how that might play out.
There's a lot of short-term rentals in the rural Washington County area now, and unfortunately, most of them are not paying lodging tax. They're not, a lot of them are not even participating on Airbnb or one of the main programs, but as long as nobody complains.
And by the way, I looked it up. So in all of Washington County for the next few days, if five adults want to stay, there's 46 places. For one adult, there's about 146. So, you know, you can, and it tells how much each one of them, you know, costs. So it's not impossible to figure out, you know, on if you were to look at all of these. Now that, of course, is excluding Craigslist or other, you know, places that you could do it that aren't traditionally thought of.
Where was it that you looked?
That's just the Airbnb
website.
So one of the things with that, though, is that they don't list addresses on any of those sites. So it's not really possible, unless you book it, to know where it's located. So you have a general location.
They show a general location. It's within half a mile of where it is. So it's difficult. It would be difficult, for example, for county staff to track that. I mean, considering that probably every day the pattern of rentals changes and you've got more than one platform, not just Airbnb. So it's sort of a shifting sands kind of a thing. But in any case, I'm going to talk about the jurisdictions that do have short-term rental-specific regulations and then some of the aspects of that. So I already indicated Clackamas County is working on those currently, and then Clatsop, Tillamook, City of Hood River, Lake Oswego, Hood River County, City of Portland, Bend, and Milwaukee. Sort of a commonality among several of these places that do have short-term rental-specific regulations is they're real popular places for people to go on vacation. You know, there's several coastal communities on this list. And then there's City of Hood River and Hood River County, the people recreating on Mount Hood, and City of Portland, biggest city in Oregon, and City of Bend, you know, Mount Bachelor. So that may be why they've been more sort of ahead of the game with short-term rental-specific regulations, is perhaps because they have more of them, or there's more potential. There was more need for them to kind of get out ahead of it a little bit. There's differences between these governments in how they all have short-term rental-specific regulations, but there's differences between them in how they issue approvals of short-term rentals, with a slight majority of them taking the approach of using a license or a permit or a registration to issue the approval. Portland and Hood River County use a land use approval to issue approval. City of Bend requires both. And then City of Milwaukee, if the short-term rental is a part of the house and not the whole house, someone can get approval through a permit, but if it's a whole house rental, they have to go through a land use approval, conditional use review. So there's a variety of approaches taken in how they're approved. There are commonalities, though, in what is being regulated in a lot of these local governments. A lot of them have requirements that there be quiet hours from 10 p.m. to 7 a.m. or otherwise limits on noise. Several of them prohibit group events like weddings. And the thought behind that is that they're trying to get at minimizing noise impacts from parties and minimizing on-street parking impacts from that kind of thing. Many of them have requirements for a minimum number of parking spaces on the site. And then some of them have maximum occupancy requirements, setting forth how many short-term rental guests can be in each bedroom or sleeping area. This is admittedly very difficult to enforce because it's hard to imagine a local government staff bursting into a short-term rental in the middle of the night with flashlights and counting people. One of the jurisdictions, the City of Hood River, acknowledged, yeah, we can't really enforce that. But they said even putting that expectation up on a placard in the short-term rental itself and requiring the contract that the person signs, you know, at least makes it so that they can't say they didn't know. So they feel like it has some benefit. And then trash management is also something that's required, making sure that there's covered trash containers and that trash is removed weekly and that the site is kept up to par.
Do we have a countywide noise ordinance for quiet generally?
We don't really have a noise ordinance. It's sort of a tough thing. Right now, noise complaints for any type of land use in the county, whether it's a commercial land use or an owner-occupied home or a short-term rental, if there's a noise complaint, and if that complaint is submitted during weekday work hours, solid waste and recycling has a code enforcement arm, and they address it at that point. If it's an evening or weekend noise complaint, it's the sheriff's department. So, and I think it's probably a little bit tough for both of those enforcement entities because they don't really have a benchmark of like decibels or anything else. Clackamas County has a noise ordinance where they specify, you know, number of decibels and, you know, noise meter reading taken at the property line, and they have a lot of stuff. We don't have anything equivalent to that. This next common...
I might just say on that, County Council may want to say something. She was indicating that.
So what I think I heard Suzanne say was there was no noise ordinance for the county. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, so there actually is a noise ordinance in the Washington County Code, but it's a very old ordinance, and you had about 90% of it correct in that... the Department of Health goes out during regular hours, and then after hours, the sheriff's office is often called. But like Suzanne said, there aren't any objective measures. It's a reasonableness standard, so it's very difficult to enforce.
But I think, you know, we have some neighbors down the street that often have parties, but right at 10, isn't 10 o'clock kind of when they're supposed to be really quiet?
I believe so.
Yeah, at 10 o'clock, they're pretty good at being quiet because the neighbors will call the sheriffs and, you know, so, you know, I think, you know, if the sheriffs kind of drive by, slow down, and the people are out in front, often that just...
Mr. Erstadt?
Yeah, I was going to say that I'm pretty sure on your cell phone, most smartphones, could probably measure the decibels of a sound. I'm not sure about that, but I suspect that that's pretty easy to do. And
yes, you can. I will confirm that.
All right.
Interesting.
That's all I got.
Jackie?
Commissioner Erstadt's comment. So it's not a matter of whether something can be measured in decibels. The problem is in the code language itself, there is no standard for what is a violation. It's just a reasonableness standard.
I will also just offer that the decibel meters that you get on apps are inherently inconsistent. And I've seen as much as 15 decibel differences when two people are standing side by side with their phone using their app decibel meter. So inherently difficult.
Yeah. This next element requires a little bit of explanation. Primary residency is used by several jurisdictions as a way to make the short-term rental operator more accountable to the neighbors. It does not require the owner to be on site when the short-term rental is rented. But what it does require is it requires when the short-term rental operator submits their application for approval, their address on their Oregon driver's license or their state tax or federal tax forms has to match the address for the short-term rental. So they can go on vacation for several months and not be there and rent the house out, but there has to be a connection between their address of record on official documents like the Oregon driver's license or tax forms and the address of the short-term rental. So that's a requirement that several jurisdictions have is, you know, that primary residency requirement. inspections by building staff are often required to verify that the short-term rental meets fire and life safety standards. Our building official indicated that the way the county is structured, the county is not authorized to inspect existing homes, that they are only authorized to inspect new construction. So if Washington County were to require inspections, that there'd probably have to be a new sort of team of people doing that. Clackamas County has that same structure where their building division is also not authorized to inspect existing homes that already have occupancy permits. And so what they're proposing is that as part of their regulations that an applicant submit an affidavit where they're verifying that they have various features in the home. And Clackamas County says that in their view it's analogous to long-term rental landlords who have sort of affidavits showing that there's been lead testing and things like that in long-term dwellings. Most jurisdictions that have short-term rental regulations require the approvals to be renewed at some regular time, either annually or every 2 years or every 5 years. And then they differ in terms of what dwelling types they allow the short-term rental to operate in, where some jurisdictions like Portland allow any dwelling type, apartment, detached home, what have you, to be used as a short-term rental, whereas others may explicitly call out certain dwelling types that are prohibited from being used as a short-term rental and that others are allowed.
The law firm that I am still associated with has about 140 coastal homeowner association communities that we represent. And there's a common theme now running up and down the Oregon coast where the association will require you to register that you're going to have your home or unit used as a short-term rental. $100 fee, roughly, in most cases. But the element that it caused me to think about when you were going through that last bit is that they are required to have someone who is available 24/7 that can be contacted in the event of a problem with parking or noise or trash or whatever it might be. And that if that person's not available when a call is made, then there is a fine associated with the fact that you didn't have someone that was able to respond immediately to that kind of a call.
Yeah, I think Clatsop and Tillamook counties both have that requirement. Those two coastal counties do. These are some enforcement considerations. I've sort of alluded to some of these already, but it's recognizing that so far, the comments that long-range planning and the board have gotten over the past 5 years are concerns about noise and concerns about parking. So just acknowledging, you know, the current enforcement entities for those and not sure whether there's an opportunity to change that, make that different for short-term rentals, or whether that is something that would need to remain as is. Our land use code enforcement staff do not work evenings and weekends. It's possible to, if the board directs development of short-term rental regulations, and then depending on what those regulations might be, there could need to be additional budget or staffing needed. But at this point, it's really hard to know about that. And I do want to note, too, and this kind of builds on Chair Vile's point, is that several local governments with short-term rental regulations have what they call neighbor enforcement, where they require the short-term rental operator to either post a placard outside the short-term rental with their contact information, or they require the short-term rental operator to mail a notice to the property owners within a certain vicinity that gives their contact information.
What jurisdiction is it?
This is several of the coastal jurisdictions require this. I think actually the city of Portland requires the notification. Clackamas County was looking at the placard idea, and they got a lot of pushback from short-term rental operators who said, I'm not sure I want to label the outside of my house as a short-term rental because people might break in if they see no one's home. It's like sort of. So I think it sort of depends on the community whether that's an issue or not. Perhaps in the coastal communities where a lot of homes are sort of clustered together on bluffs, there's not the opportunity for somebody to sneak around and do something where there aren't other eyes. But in Clackamas County, which has big rural areas and big areas like we do, there might be an opportunity for maybe things to go awry. So the next steps are that in a couple of weeks, the issue paper is going to be finalized. It's going to be published with the Long Range Planning Work Program and posted on our webpage at the same time the work program is. And then there's going to be a month-long comment period for the whole work program and for the short-term rental issue paper that'll conclude in late February. We're expecting that in late March, the board will give direction on next steps, considering the issue paper guidance and probably public comment submitted during the comment period after the issue paper is posted. I have been going to CPO briefings and giving this sort of essentially the same presentation. I went to CPO 7 a couple weeks ago, and I was at CPO 1 last night, and next week I'm going to be at CPO 4B. And these questions were asked. It was kind of interesting because at CPO 7, I think there were probably about 10 to 12 folks there. I didn't count, but most of the folks that were there, some of them expressed concerns about short-term rentals, although many of them raised their hands when they were asked whether they'd ever stayed at a short-term rental. Almost all of them raised their hands. Last night at CPO 1, we had 40 people, which the CPO 1 chair was sort of amazed at, and they were pretty much all there for the short-term rental topic. About half of them were short-term rental operators that belonged to a local short-term rental trade association called Host to Host that's based in Portland. I guess it's one of the few, one of them said it's one of the few sort of locally grown kind of trade associations for that, and they, a couple of them were speaking about the fact that they list their short-term rentals on the online booking platforms like Airbnb, and they get some assistance and guidance from Airbnb on sort of best practices and how to get along with the neighbors and such, but they thought that they also needed to not just get sort of support and ideas from sort of like a faraway corporate entity, but that actual local operators should get together and sort of problem solve ways to sort of have their business be more harmonious. So
remind us of where CPO 1 is.
CPO 1 is in Cedar Mill.
Okay, and CPO 7?
Is in Bethany.
Bethany, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Commissioner Bartholomew.
I was just curious, there's obviously hundreds of these operating as we speak. How often do you get a complaint? I haven't heard that they've been a big problem.
It doesn't seem, I mean, we, Long Range Planning has gotten sort of clusters of complaints over the past 5 years about certain, I think a total of about 5 operating short-term rentals. There'll be like a cluster of neighbors that will all submit complaints about one that they're all surrounding. Apparently, I've talked to our code enforcement staff, and they don't get too many complaints about short-term rentals. Our current planning staff get calls pretty much every week from people wanting to know if they need to get some kind of permit or approval from the county to operate a short-term rental, and they're told we don't regulate them. So there's obviously a lot of interest out there, and I don't doubt that there's a lot of people that are doing it. I don't know what a lot means, but there's obviously plenty of operators out there. So it will be sort of interesting to see. I think it was interesting last night to also get additional feedback from residents with concerns, but also stories from short-term rental operators that were saying that a lot of them are trying really hard to make their business be seamless with neighbors, and that even if they're not occupying the house, that they make a point of getting to know all the neighbors in the neighborhood and talk with those neighbors and ask them, you know, is everything going okay? Are the guests, so, you know, going okay? Is there anything I need to do? So there's seems like there's good actors out there and some bad actors out there. So.
All right, thank you.
Sounds like very few bad actors, though, right? Just five in the whole county?
Well, it's sort of hard to know if those are the only ones or just the only ones we've heard about. I don't know if, as time goes on, like when this issue paper is posted, if we'll hear about both more good and bad actors than we've heard about to date. So it's just really hard for us to get a handle on. I mean, I agree with what you're saying, but it's hard for us to really get a handle on the proportion of good versus bad.
Commissioner Beatty.
Yeah, just as a comment and personal observation, I've got multiple friends who have run short-term rentals, and I've never one time heard of a problem. And me personally, I've stayed in short-term rentals all over East Coast, you know, urban New York, Iceland, Europe, Canada, Mexico. And I've used the Vrbo, Airbnb, HomeAway, all of the platforms, so I'm very familiar with it. And it seems to me that the owner or the whoever the manager is, if there's a manager in there, but it seems to me the owner really self-regulates most of this. All the places I've stayed, it seems they're very particular on what they will allow and not allow. I've stayed in places where it's, you know, here's the noise ordinance thing, and that's it. Here's the fire extinguisher. Here's 911. And I've stayed at other places that are very conservative on, you know, no smoking, no drinking, no glitter, no, you know, no parties, no babies, whatever. Mm-hmm. And are very quick, I've heard, to find people, you know, as applicable. But it seems that any rightful owner would want that tenant to follow those rules so that they are, you know, a good neighbor, so they continue to run and operate their business. And I guess, you know, as somebody has used this in multiple locations, and I've seen every kind of binder and posting and key lock box option there is, and I've never seen an issue or had an issue.
I'm inclined to chime in behind Commissioner Beatty, and, you know, maybe this is a swan song feeling, but I would sure hope we didn't try to regulate something or at least over-regulate something that maybe isn't busted at this point. It's clear that this is a trend that is accelerating, but if we've got five or six in the whole county that are sort of the bad actors that have been identified, that seems to be a very, very small reason to engage in a big regulatory effort.
Chair Bile, I want to chime in because I think Suzanne has kind of underestimated the few bad actors that we've had, that they've been advertised party houses, so you can, you know, come from afar and meet all your friends or your frat brothers or whatever, and, you know, just come in for the night. There was one in Rock Creek, I believe, that there was a murder at. So clearly it's those extreme cases that kind of got it on the board's agenda, I think. And so I think that's where the concern is, as opposed to ones that I think most people have stayed in that don't seem to be a problem.
I definitely think we should outlaw murder.
Commissioner Mills, then Commissioner Erstadt.
I have really no experience with these, but we have had people come and speak to us about some of the most problematic ones. And, you know, I think there is a big difference between an Airbnb that is renting one bed to one person who's going to stay there one or two nights, and these party houses. And those are what I'm concerned about. And perhaps there's... If we could come up with some type of capacity limit, so if it's five or more, perhaps. Now, that might be difficult, you know, to come up with. But I think that they're probably, and I understand, and I often support some of the libertarian sentiment that we get here, but I've also argued that sometimes when you have some type of regulation, it allows the owners to know clearly what they can and can't do. And I don't have the answer for this, but I'm sympathetic to people who live next to a large house that is, you know, used as party houses or murder houses, perhaps. So, you know, I think that while, you know, 99% of them cause no problems, some of them are going to cause problems. You know, there were 53 or 63 people arrested for drunk driving last week in the county. There's 600,000 people that live in the county. That's a very small percentage, but it can still cause a problem. And so.
Thank you. Commissioner Erstadt.
Well, I'm just not going to let it go, I guess. But I think there, if there's, sounds like the biggest issue is sound. And so why don't you put a decibel limit in the sound thing? And why don't they have a decibel meter? I kind of think you can get a cheap decibel meter if the police need to come out. I do think, though, that was a good idea, maybe limiting the people, because not that I've ever been to a party, but usually when you get a lot of people, it gets louder and louder and louder. And but I do think that places I've lived in Washington County, there was way more problem with the permanent people than the bed and breakfast. I mean, we all knew who was partying on the street, and there was huge noise. And I don't know why there isn't a noise code, because that's, I mean, it'll keep you up all night, people partying. But I think the noise code might solve a bunch of it. And I actually think that's a pretty good idea, that limiting it to a certain number of people. So that's all I got.
Mr. Petrola, did you have something?
Yes. It's not just the negative effects that I think is the purpose of a regulation, whether it's here or elsewhere. I mean, some of it is to achieve public policy goals related to affordable housing or maintaining the rental stock, whether or maintaining a certain standard of living. So it's, you know, there's several facets of this. It's not all just trying to respond to complaints. But I want to put a couple of data points on the record. And one is, I believe, like at the CPO meeting, the community policing rep said that they get complaints regularly. I wasn't sure what the nature of them were, but I did recommend, since I was in attendance, that it might be worthwhile checking with the sheriff's office to see what their logging is on the complaint side and maybe the nature of them. And it's a difficult it's a fascinating phenomenon, because when these things businesses occur like this, it catches people flat-footed, and it not sure how to respond. And then of course it's a divisive issue, because there's people on both sides of it. This isn't going to go away. I was just looking at some of the statistics. Airbnb has 3 million listings in the United States. You know, that's more than Marriott and Hilton combined. 20% of the U.S. lodging market is Airbnb. Consumers spend more at Airbnb than they do at Hilton. And Airbnb hasn't even gone public yet. I believe an IPO is scheduled this year, if I guess maybe the election or the market conditions are favorable. So once they have their IPO, I mean, they're going to have billions of dollars sitting in the bank to become more of a juggernaut. They do dominate the market. I mean, when we talk about there's others, I mean, they're probably half the market. And then VBRO is like a quarter, and then the others. And the different cities, I mean, there's areas where the effect has to be addressed. The cities have moved to, because the effect was clearly negative and visual, or, you know, in Bend, for instance, because of its being a destination, you could stay up at a place and there might be four on one street and people are coming and there's not enough parking. So it's not just noise. It's the, you know, the parking, the coming and going, the idea that we zoned to separate residential and commercial activities. And if somebody's operating what on a, you know, weekly, you know, several days a week, it starts to look like a commercial activity, which isn't really what the zone is. So it's sort of, you know, I think we still are going to have some, it's going to take some time to figure out what the best approach is. But the reason we're talking about it is because there were letters submitted and complaints registered, and the issues become more visible publicly. And our commissioners said it's time for us to take a look at it and to see what where to go. And I would, you know, I don't want to just throw in opinions, but I do think we just have to not knee-jerk it and recognize that it is part of the economic landscape for hospitality. We aren't a destination per se where there's five or six on one street. The way that other locations might be, Hood River being one. I know Asheville, North Carolina, has heavily regulated them because they're afraid of losing housing stock. So, you know, I guess that concludes. I really don't want to, I don't want us to overregulate. And there's people I know who are making nice supplemental income off it that. Either need that income or it's being used in the economy. And so, you know, there's so many factors to consider. I just don't want it just to be, oh, it's a noise issue or it's a party house issue. It's more complex than that.
I just wanted to just say one thing to follow up on Commissioner Petrillo with regard to the sheriffs. I did have talked to sheriff's deputy staff. They say that they don't really have a sense because when people call in with noise complaints, they don't tell the sheriff that it's a short-term rental. So the sheriffs have no idea like what the scope of the noise complaints are with short-term rentals versus owner-occupied houses. So just wanted to add that.
Quick question for Suzanne.
Commissioner Beatty?
Do you know on the TLTs that are collected, do those go in the same coffer as like hotel lodging taxes?
They do.
Okay. Well, I mean, it seems to me that, you know, as this industry grows, that the, you know, transient lodging tax and the other economic benefits far outweighs four or five complaints a year.
Yeah, we don't want to kill the golden goose, but I do agree with much of what Commissioner Petrillo said also. Matt?
Only one comment that my tendency would be for lesser in the way of regulation, and the other thing it was that you've done a really good job, especially at this early stage. You like left no stone uncovered. Was the only other comment. So.
Thank you.
Just real quick, I didn't mean to suggest to limit short-term rentals to a maximum of five. I was suggesting that there be a cutoff where there is no or less regulation if it's just you know, one bed where somebody's staying in, as opposed to a party house or a larger house, hopefully not a party house, that could be legal but would be have a higher capacity, just for the benefit of my colleagues.
All right. Does anybody have any further questions of staff on this matter? I'll echo the sentiment that you guys have done a very good job in researching and presenting this, and very much appreciate it, so thank you. We have one final matter on the agenda this evening, and that is the consideration of the minutes from the October 16, 2019 meeting. I'll entertain a motion.
I move that we approve the minutes as written for that date.
Second.
Moved and seconded that we adopt the minutes as prepared by staff of October 16th, 2019. Is there any objection? Without objection, those minutes will be adopted. Does anyone have anything further?
I'd like to move a resolution for the Planning Commission thanking and honoring the three Planning Commissioner members who have served and contributed over the last several years, and wish them well and thank them for the time. I'd appreciate a second.
Second.
This is awkward. It's been moved and seconded that a resolution be adopted, recognizing and appreciating the three members of the Planning Commission who will be leaving as of this meeting. Any discussion? Any objection? Without objection, that resolution is adopted. Thank you, Commissioner Petrillo. And without objection, we will be adjourned. Thank you.